Happy New Year. My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the Dean at Perkins School of Theology, and I have the pleasure and the privilege of welcoming you to the first of our Faith and Business Luncheons for calendar year 2016. I am pleased to introduce to you our two speakers. I'm going to introduce both of them, and then each of them will get up and in turn deliver a presentation, and then as time allows, Dr. John Martin, our Director of Development, will moderate a conversation, try to facilitate questions and answers, but keeping in mind that the Q&A period will extend as long as time allows. There are a couple of announcements that I know John will want to make before we conclude the afternoon, and we want to keep faith with you for the schedule of the afternoon. So let me begin by introducing the first of our two speakers. Catherine Cuellar serves with the Communities Foundation of Texas as Director, Entrepreneurs for North Texas. In that role, she fosters businesses and social ventures. Prior to that, she was Executive Director of the Dallas Arts District, the largest contiguous urban cultural neighborhood in the United States, and world headquarters of the Global Cultural Districts Network. For two decades, she worked as an award-winning multimedia journalist for national public radio stations and programs on the West Coast and here in Dallas as well as nationally. She also has been writing for and working with Sojourners Magazine and the Dallas Morning News, among others. She spent 5 years as communications manager for Oncor, the sixth largest electric power grid in the United States. Currently, Ms. Cuellar serves on the boards of the Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse and the Rhodes College Alumni Association, and she is also an active member of First Presbyterian Church in Dallas, where she serves on the session of ruling elders. She is a native of the Dallas area. She is a 2014 Next Generation Project Texas Fellow at the Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas in Austin. She has been recognized among the Dallas Business Journal's 2013 40 Under 40 honorees and was honored in 2007 as one of Dallas Junior Chamber of Commerce's 5 outstanding young Dallasites. In my conversation with her at lunch, as I learned some things about her broadcasting career, I discovered that one of her first jobs was to be in charge of the fundraising campaign for public radio and television, which means I'll bet she's got a closet full of tote bags and coffee mugs. We are indeed privileged to have with us Catherine Cuellar. I invite you to join us in welcoming. Immediately after Catherine speaks, we will hear from our second speaker, Dr. Christopher Anderson. Chris Anderson is Associate Professor of Sacred Music here at Perkins School of Theology. Chris is an organ specialist. He is professor of organ. He is an astonishingly fine organist, both as a recitalist and as a service performer. And if you want to know how important the distinction is, have a conversation with Chris about the organists in the world who are amazing at organ performance and recitalists, but haven't a clue how to lead a congregation in singing hymns. The reverse is also true. Chris has been a regular contributor to the Biennial International Organ Academy in Sweden, and in 2005 was a featured lecturer at the Bruckner University in Linz, Austria. His archival research has involved the central musical institutions of the cities of Leipzig and Meiningen, Germany. Chris regularly appears as an organ recitalist with a repertoire that extends from the 16th century to the newest music for organ. Chris is a graduate of Southern Methodist University, has a master's degree from Stuttgart, earned his PhD in performance practice from Duke University. Chris is not only an accomplished organist, and a great teacher and a wonderful faculty colleague who is involved in all the aspects of our life as a school here at Perkins. He also is one of the truly astonishing research scholars in the field of organ music in the world. Chris has been working on a biography of one of the most remarkable figures in organ teaching and research, late 19th, early 20th century figure. One of the challenges Chris faced in turning his research into biography was to decide whether he would, in the end, write the biography in English or in German. And I'll let him tell you, if he wishes, which language he's chosen and why. But when Chris shared with me some of the substance of his research, he helped me understand what a challenge it is to revisit critical periods in history when things like organ music were not simply pieces that were written intended to be performed or played in religious or secular settings, but when they were also evocative of the events that were happening at the time the person was writing and composing. And so it is that in reading, for instance, the notes of the scholar he studied, it became a little tiresome, Chris noted, to have to read at the end of every one of that person's letters the words, Heil Hitler. It is important to remember how complex are the times in which we live. And I am privileged to introduce to you today one of our great teachers and one of the great organ scholars in the world, Dr. Christopher Anderson.
Well, time's up. No, thank you for having me today. It is actually intimidating for me to be here because my parents are here with their friends, as well as ordained ministers from several different churches where I have worshiped throughout my circuitous and meandering faith journey. And this campus of SMU is actually where my dad got his law degree and where my maternal grandfather got his undergrad and law degrees. Even though I've gone to events at Perkins Chapel and the Meadows Museum and in McFarland Auditorium, I was afraid I was not going to find you and that I was going to be disruptive coming in late. So I think for many of my colleagues and contemporaries, their first visit to a house of worship feels the same way. Even if we've seen it from the outside and driven past it dozens or even hundreds of times, even if our friends and families have been faithful members for generations. Faith inspired many business leaders to establish in advance some of our region's most enduring and most needed institutions, including Children's Medical Center, St. Paul Hospital at UT Southwestern, Presbyterian and Methodist hospitals, Genesis Women's Shelter, The Bridge, City Square, Vogel Alcove, just to name a few. These success stories are among the best reasons why we as business leaders must not limit our witness to private worship. Our civic engagement and business scruples either refute or confirm what our colleagues and neighbors assume regarding faithful people based on local news reports about inappropriate student-teacher relations at Episcopal School of Dallas, or Walker Raley's trial, or Robert Tilton abusing his tax-exempt status. Silence assumes consent. Stories like these make it easy to understand why young adults drift away from church during their late teens and 20s, and if we as people of faith don't live our values publicly, then no one can see us privately repent from that. Media is part of both the problem and the solution. As an associate news producer covering events from 9/11 through the start of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, I suffered a crisis of conscience about how my colleagues and I abdicated our journalistic responsibility by reporting unverified claims of weapons of mass destruction or connections between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. I almost left journalism for good in 2003, but was lured back to local newsrooms at KERA and online to cover school board, city council, and county commissioners' courts. issues I thought could make a local difference. But as Peter Jennings and Tim Russert passed away, and Dan Rather, Ted Koppel, and Bell Moyers retired, they weren't replaced by journalists of the same caliber. Instead, news anchors scroll through social media feeds, reading audience posts live without editing, context, or analysis. The craft of journalism as a public service informing citizens has lost out to ratings delivering audiences to advertisers. Last year, my Dallas ISD school board member was returned to office by fewer than 300 votes, and several Dallas City Council races were decided by a few dozen votes. Voter turnout is less than 10%. The winners are neither Democrats nor Republicans, but fear and apathy. So when Perkins asked me to consider if something important to my life or our society ever trumps profitability, my answer is, hell yes! In my 20s and again in my 40s, I took pay cuts to leave corporate America, and most of my career, I've worked in the notoriously lucrative fields of journalism and nonprofits. Next month, my husband will be 50, and he can't be here today because he's a first-year teacher in the Dallas ISD. Twenty years ago, he left corporate America to pursue a 20-year career in the music business. We met 6 years ago at a concert, and our shared passion for arts and entertainment unites and rewards us in immeasurable ways. We also love going to the movies. And the popularity of current films like Star Wars, Spotlight, and The Big Short are great examples of the power of storytelling. We listen and share stories in community, and all are transformed. These tales draw us in with characters who are flawed yet sympathetic. Works of fiction which challenge our beliefs and make us reconsider what we think we know. In this way, great films and great works of literature and art can be even more inspiring, influential, and unifying, sometimes than even facts. My employer, Communities Foundation of Texas, helped fund research which found that more than a third of Dallas residents live in asset poverty, a new term defining a lack of resources to support a household for 3 months at the federal poverty level. That's less than $5,000 for a family of three should they lose their main source of income. When I discuss this statistic with generous people of faith in our business community, some simply say, astonished, I don't see it. But when KERA started giving families in asset poverty a voice through their One Crisis Away series, listeners were riveted and shared what they heard. My husband and I experience income inequality in an intimate and personal way. Our 75215 zip code and our home between the bridge and Dallas Life in southern Dallas has Dallas County's highest concentration of service providers supporting our most vulnerable neighbors facing homelessness, domestic violence, mental illness, addiction, a family member who's incarcerated, or some combination of these. Although the journalistic code of ethics required me to be impartial, I was flabbergasted to interview people of faith campaigning against service providers expanding their services or criminalizing symptoms of homelessness, ignoring, mistreating, or blaming the poor for their circumstances, reporting on HIV-positive patients in hospice, families of fallen soldiers, or New Orleans residents displaced by Hurricane Katrina led me to live in southern Dallas and advocate in partnership with my neighbors. There's nothing more humbling than having to run a correction after not getting a story exactly right. So I feel for the inspired prophets, scribes, rabbis, and priests, all imperfect and dependent on grace, who have heard, recorded, and interpreted God's story, the Bible, longer than anyone knows or remembers. I'm deeply moved by these common stories, which are no less powerful, even though sometimes contradictory. And I continue to seek ways God has revealed through us today. My parents taught me that faith in Scripture is not contrary to reason or logic. We were lucky to grow up in a wonderful multicultural community filled with very smart business people of all faiths, including Baha'i, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist. I went to public schools in Richardson ISD when Texas represented the vanguard of scientific thought and innovation through Texas Instruments, UT Southwestern, MD Anderson, and NASA. I took a high school physics field trip to the superconducting super collider in Waxahachie. So as a person of faith and as an employer and a product of public schools, I'm alarmed our governor has appointed a homeschooler who has never had a child in public schools to chair our state board of education. And that religious zeal, rather than academic rigor, seems to be the new standard for adopting our history and science textbooks. I also grew up in the heart of Dallas's large and diverse Jewish community. And some of my classmates at Park Hill Junior High were the children of my mom's classmates from Hillcrest High School in Dallas, and even grandchildren of my grandfather's classmates from what used to be Forest Avenue High School, now James Madison by Fair Park. My grandfather recalled the rabbi giving a kosher par of blessing to the Dr. Peppers in the school cafeteria. Some of my classmates and neighbors were grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. Far more were first-generation immigrants from South Africa. Through our friendships, I became keenly aware of the injustice of apartheid and could not have imagined South Africa's peaceful transition to adopt the most progressive, inclusive constitution in the world. I need a sip of water. Could you hand me that iced tea? Sorry. In 2000, I visited Harare, Zimbabwe, during a nationwide shortage of petrol, with people queued up for days awaiting the chance to refill their automobiles. Robert Mugabe was seizing private farms, redistributing them to his cronies, and torturing and executing his critics, including journalists. My friend Mari was a Presbyterian missionary there, operating a home for street children orphaned by HIV and AIDS. We went to church, and the sermon was from Proverbs 29, contrasting a just and wise king with a foolish and wicked king. Though Mugabe and current events were never discussed, I understood the fear of persecution and the blessing of liberation like never before, confirming my conviction that our nation and my faith are strongest because the state and church are separate. We went on to South Africa, where we toured a township as well as many more homes for street children, most of whom had HIV. I even sold a feature story about my trip there, and realized that my worst day in the States is often better than many other people's best day ever. So I try to complain less and take more chances. On that visit, we also went to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was incarcerated. I went back to Robben Island in 2012 with a group from First Presbyterian Church of Dallas. And the greatest difference between my two visits was that in the dozen years between trips, we opened Guantanamo Bay. So while South Africa, which had been reviled throughout my youth and childhood for apartheid, proudly left torture and incarceration without charge or trial in the 20th century, the U.S. has dragged enhanced interrogation into the 21st century, and I felt ashamed, especially since during that same trip in 2012, I got to meet Nobel Peace Prize winner Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the National Director of Research for South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Charles Villavicencio, who has renounced his ordination as a Methodist minister, but remains a public theologian. And I cannot imagine a more faithful and powerful professional witness to all humanity than his work through the commission, which showed our fragile and broken world, hungry for healing, how transformational storytelling and listening could be. To understand how faith became such a big part of my career and life, it helps to know my family. And I'd like to thank my mom and dad, John and Susan Cuellar, who just celebrated their 45th wedding anniversary and are here today. And my mom is already blushing, so if you need to go on walkabout, this is going to be about us. Sorry, Mom. My dad is Mexican-American. My mom is Anglo. My dad has been a 5-time political appointee of Republican governors, including Governor Abbott, Governor Perry, and George W. Bush. My mom has volunteered in support of Democratic campaigns as far back as George McGovern's 1972 presidential bid in the only state he carried, Massachusetts, where my dad was getting his MBA at the time. So perhaps it was only natural I became a journalist because they taught me to see both sides of every story and to ask a lot of questions. My dad is a 24-karat Catholic, having attended Christ the King and Jesuit and Notre Dame. My parents got married at Christ the King soon after Vatican II. My sister and I were both baptized in the Catholic Church, and our family was a co-founding member of All Saints when Mass was held in the cafetorium of Prestonwood Elementary, and Sunday school classes were taught in the gym. My maternal grandparents, who co-founded Churchill Way Presbyterian Church and were later elders there and at Preston Hollow Presbyterian Church, were suspect to some of our fellow parishioners and family members who felt due to their pre-Vatican II beliefs, that they might not get into heaven because they weren't Catholic. Now, this is a joke between me and my dad, who says, this proves that the Catholic Church is the one true faith whenever Notre Dame wins a football game. But, and he can still recite the Mass in Latin from memory from when he was an altar boy. But it compelled my mom to return to her Presbyterian roots, ultimately joining Canyon Creek Presbyterian Church in Richardson, so my sister and I could experience grace instead of guilt and serve as highly as we felt called. If my parents had two sons instead of two daughters, my mom might have continued as a Catholic so we could worship as a family. But if she had, we would have grown up in the same youth group as predator priest Rudy Koss, whose first victim to break the silence against him and the diocese for negligence was one of my neighbors and school classmates. During my junior high and high school years, our Presbyterian church staff had more than a half dozen different directors of youth ministry. But despite our consistent lack of professionally trained adult role models, God did something amazing. As tween and teenagers, we discerned what was needed and used our gifts to serve each other, our church, and our community, developing our leadership skills along the way. Unlike some adults in our congregation who expected to be served and shepherded, my peers and friends then, as now, were eager and willing to serve and give back. We didn't have money to give, but we were lucky time and again to find community helping us to discern and align our purpose and mission while setting up chairs, building houses, painting churches, mentoring, planning and leading fellowship and worship, delivering meals, writing prayers, singing Christmas carols to people in nursing homes, or making coffee. Whether Christians acting as Jesus' hands and feet or Jewish people demonstrating the concept of tikkun olam to heal the world, if we're not living our values on the job, why would our friends want to come and worship with us? I briefly contemplated seminary, but my faith is too fragile for me to depend on it to pay my bills. So instead, I decided to support clergy and church staff as a volunteer in youth and young adult ministry. But four women from Canyon Creek who I studied and volunteered with as a youth and young adult are now ministers of Word and Sacrament in the Presbyterian Church USA. And this summer, I was the ruling elder participating in the ordination of one from a small group I led for 6 years. Before I married, while working as a journalist, my professional colleagues often became my roommates. I lived with a Sephardic Jewish photojournalist who was born in Morocco and traveled to Israel for her wedding. I also lived in Oak Lawn with two Indian women, one Telugu and one Bengali, who allowed their parents to arrange their marriages. I ended up including them in a story I sold to a national women's magazine. My final roommate before I married was a KERA colleague who had been raised in the Catholic Church and school until his brother came out of the closet and was rejected by the church, so he and his brother both ended up atheist. Sharing homes and traveling with these friends, our interfaith dialogues were challenging but always respectful. Though I'm first to admit my housekeeping as a roommate was not the most faithful testimony. Though I was confirmed Presbyterian, I was also a co-founding member and leader in young adult fellowships at Episcopalian churches and American Baptist UCC churches. And more recently, in my professional life in the Dallas Arts District, I got to work with two of Dallas's oldest historic churches, Cathedral Guadalupe and First Methodist and St. Paul United Methodist. Based on my own circuitous and meandering faith journey, I try to avoid joking, even among faithful people, at the expense of any denomination or sect. People like my husband, who is the son of a Church of Christ minister and has been formally excommunicated by his parents, don't know the differences between denominations, so don't feel in on the joke, which affirms long-held assumptions, in my husband's case, that he doesn't belong. To him and to my LGBTQ and Jewish and Hindu and Muslim professional colleagues, I often find myself apologizing for the judgment, rejection, and exclusion they have faced from our fellow Christians, including some of our local clergy in the national media who don't know them. If our neighbors make themselves vulnerable and share their most precious non-renewable resource, their time, only to feel rejected or excluded, can we blame them if they quit trying? That's why I think sharing our faith by example through professional and personal dealings is preferable to imagining that people will ignore imposing architecture and lifelong cliques, risk sitting alone or worse in someone else's usual spot, despite no knowledge of such unwritten rules, then profess our beliefs, though they may lack the vocabulary or experience to comprehend them. We can best be a living witness by assuming the character of servant leadership in all we say and do. And that is why I am so excited and honored to lead Entrepreneurs for North Texas, which is a 15-year-old program of the Communities Foundation of Texas. Just as CFT has a 60-year history of helping generous individuals hone in on their philanthropic priorities and be strategic about their giving, Entrepreneurs for North Texas does the same for companies and their executives. We make it easy for our 100 member companies to engage employees and create a culture of good corporate citizenship by helping them to identify their focus and evaluate their opportunities for engagement through that lens. Leveraging their employee volunteerism, their in-kind contributions, and their sponsorship opportunities in ways that enhance their brand and help their businesses to grow. Throughout each year, we organize a buffet of drop-in service projects we call plug-and-plays in every sector of philanthropy. And any employee from any member company can sign up and show up. We set it up, we clean it up, we measure it, we take pictures of it. Everybody high-fives and hugs and goes back to work, and you know, we give them the information they need to celebrate that in their social media and their newsletters and their annual reports. Our biggest event of the year is on 9/11, a commemorative day of service called Freedom Day, which has united almost 1,000 volunteers, including Hindu and Muslim and Jewish and Christian people of faith in service to veterans and first responders. Our next service project, as our projects on weekends and summers are always, will be open to the spouses and children of our member companies' employees on Martin Luther King Day, serving meals at Dallas Life and the Bridge. Each member company also gets one custom service project per year, and companies can use that to create a good culture and engage their employees and build camaraderie across employees, whether they're working at different locations or working different schedules, or maybe their longtime employees are getting to know their new hires in that way. We also have leadership development for employees within the company who we call engagement captains. Those are the people within the company who are actually passing out the sheets to get people to sign up to volunteer, or putting out the supply boxes to collect food or clothes or school supplies, and then making sure once collected, those go where they're supposed to. We have quarterly professional development days for our engagement captains. And then in the spring, we have a ceremonial event, the Spirit of Entrepreneurship, honoring one of our member companies as a North Star company for five-star corporate citizenship, and honoring a philanthropic entrepreneur in our Ring of Honor. Those honorees have included people like Roger Staubach and Herb Kelleher and Nebby Halliday. Pardon me. Our Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "No work is insignificant. All labor that uplifts humanity has dignity and importance and should be undertaken with painstaking excellence." Dr. King felt a sense of urgency about his faith-inspired work because he knew his life might be cut short. Similarly, I feel a sense of urgency about my faith-inspired work, and not because my life is threatened, although I do walk and bicycle in downtown Dallas alongside increasingly distracted drivers. My vision has been impaired since I was a child. I had my first surgery to repair my torn retinas when I was 11. My surgeon didn't know how long the procedure would last because I was by far his youngest patient, and most of his patients passed away before they needed a second procedure. I needed more surgeries in 2007, which I could not have survived without help from my parents. I spent 8 days flat on my back, unsure whether the process would work. I had plenty of time to go through all of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, as well as to listen for the still small voice of God. If I need another procedure in 10 or 15 years, hopefully technology will have a more permanent fix. The only thing I can do to protect my vision is to get plenty of rest, but I feel the need to work as long and hard as I can while I have the gift of sight. A former coworker of mine who is also a member of my YMCA and a devout Catholic once asked why I wasn't Catholic. I explained that while Catholics believe in communion's transubstantiation, the host and wine transformed into Jesus' body and blood, Protestants believe communion transforms us into Jesus' body, eyes, hands, feet, heart, and mind, manifesting God's heavenly realm here on earth. Despite grave concern from some of our Catholic family members, my mom has remained a member of Canyon Creek Presbyterian Church for more than 30 years, where she has taught Sunday school for more than 2 decades and served as a clerk of session and a delegate to the PCUSA General Assembly, and In 2012, she participated in my ordination as a fourth-generation ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church. My dad is still Catholic, and he goes to Mass every week. However, since he is unrepentant for breaking his wedding vow to raise my sister and me Catholic, he hasn't gone to confession or taken communion regularly in the Catholic Church for decades. But occasionally, he will visit the Presbyterian Church, and sometimes he will take communion from my mom or me. When my Catholic coworker learned this, he said, "He's not supposed to do that." And I know he said it from a place of genuine concern for the fate of my and my dad's eternal souls. But if the gospel isn't good news for everyone, it isn't good news. Grace is real. Love wins. God is love. Jesus' strongest woes warned religious people who judged others in God's name. There is no hierarchy of sin, and nothing in creation is beyond God's victory. All with knowledge of this extravagant reconciliation are liberated. St. Francis of Assisi said, "It is no use walking anywhere to preach unless our walking is our preaching." So thank you for walking with me and listening to my story. And as we continue our faith journey together, Chris and I decided it would be appropriate for us to sing the first stanza of a hymn fit for this occasion, which is on your table, "I Love to Tell the Story."
Good afternoon. I hate to follow that. Let me thank you for allowing me to be here today and to respond briefly to Catherine's thoughtful remarks. You're going to have to put up with my voice, which is getting over this horrible cold thing. I'm on the back end of it, but it kind of goes in and out, so I'm sorry about that. When John Martin asked me to participate in this conversation, I almost declined, actually, although I don't think you know that, but I almost did, because the stated task was to provide some theological frame in which the relationship between faith and business functions, or something like that, using as a departure point this virtuosic and really challenging talk which Catherine has offered us. Now, I have to tell you that I'm not a theologian, I'm not a business person, but rather a musician and a historian. So to stand in front of you and presume to say something relevant actually strikes me as a pretty big risk, but I'll try. My background is very different from Catherine's. I grew up in rural western Kentucky in a small Methodist congregation. I had an affinity for music, fortunately promoted by my largely unmusical parents, despite a deep cultural skepticism about the arts amounting to anything really useful. Certainly a boy or a male being in the arts was doubly suspect. My first church position was as the piano and pump organ player. I love those things, those pump organ things, at a tiny clapboard Methodist church on the county line. I remember the hardwood floors, the adjoining cemetery, and the framed bullet hole on the side of the building, preserved from a Civil War battle on the grounds. They were really proud of that bullet hole. The most important formation from my childhood and youth came not from some unlikely encounter with the music of Bach or Beethoven, but rather from summers and holidays spent helping my father in his business as a heating and refrigeration repairman. From him I learned how to wire electric outlets, service washing machine transmissions, how to crawl under houses and in attics in the summer. It's hot in attics in the summer. To install ductwork without disturbing the wasps and other beasties that live in these spaces. How to mix concrete. How to deal with the differences between gas and electric ovens. My farmer friends, most of my friends were farmers, had similar backgrounds. They knew about planting seasons, the process of curing tobacco, and how to repair a tractor engine. I'm telling you this because I want to make the point that the most enduring impression of my past has to do with the value of handwork and craft, with the dirty reality of laboring not behind a desk, but with stuff. This is what I call a fleshy mode of living in the world that involves tenacity and the near constant awareness that the product of your labor means the difference between something that either obviously functions or obviously does not. It isn't the life of the mind, but rather the life of your hands and body. In a few minutes, I want to show you why these experiences take on a larger significance for me. For now, though, let me make a counterintuitive leap. We'll leave that behind. It seems to me that the ethical heart of the Christian faith is condensed in Jesus' well-known two-part exposition of the law, recorded, for instance, in Matthew 22, "Love the Lord your God with heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang," he says with the largest possible brushstroke, "on these two commandments." And indeed, this God and neighbor axis, as I like to call it, must be the framework for human thought and action in a Christian view. I can tell you that it's played an enormous role in the history of music, and that no church musician today or in the past could possibly function coherently without some sort of appeal to it. One of the great confessions in the Book of Common Prayer orients entirely around it. "We have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves." Accordingly, we are enjoined to think deeply and widely about what this two-pronged ethic of God and neighbor actually means. But there's an enormous problem with it. We, as people of faith, have proven ourselves pretty good at the first part, at least on the surface of things. We feel good about praising God from whom all blessings flow. As in other times and places, it has become fashionable also for our politicians today to conflate love of God and country, to maintain that God is on our side. Various sects of the faith regularly cited their unique relationship with the divine as license to look either with pity, disdain, or outright belligerence toward those who believe differently or not at all. Loving God, it appears, frequently has resulted not in openness, but in the construction of gated communities, its members more than prepared to live lives of self-satisfied mutual exclusion. Years ago, when I converted and became a Lutheran, I was struck by the uncomfortable humor of some clever lines by Garrison Keillor. I always still have them with me. "If you come to church, don't expect to be hugged. Don't expect your hand to be shook. If we need to know who you are, we can look in the visitor's book." I was raised to keep a lid on it. Guard what you say or do. A mighty fortress is our God, so he must be Lutheran too. The truth is that, with respect to your and my position in the human community, writ large, loving God is a good deal easier than loving neighbor. The ineffable and intangible author of the universe, after all, doesn't talk back to you, doesn't argue with you, and at the end of the day, allows you to go to bed at night convinced that your view of things reflects the divine will. This is an awesome thought. That your view reflects the divine will. A spectacularly misguided one, to be sure. See the story of Job. But awesome nonetheless, and somehow it ends up being sufficient for many people. But it ignores the second half of the axis, the God and neighbor axis, the engagement with the neighbor. As soon as we are forced to confront that clause, a Pandora's box of messy questions immediately demands attention. Who exactly is the neighbor? What is the open relationship required by love of or benefit of or profit to the neighbor? Clearly, this asks significantly more than an individual's love and worship of an exalted God. It is not a vertical relation to the deity, but rather a horizontal one, to the flesh and bone of the human community. Jesus points out that the Hebrew law, in essence, demands human relationship if one's relation to God is to be squared. And the scripture not only forbids us to disassociate love of God from love of neighbor, but goes as far as to assert that the former can only follow from the latter. If anyone says, I love God and hates his neighbor, so in 1 John chapter 4, he is a liar. For he who does not love his neighbor whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. This is an audacious challenge. Possibly it seems to me the central challenge of the entire Christian religion. And for 2 millennia, we have spent an extraordinary amount of effort and time to circumvent it. In this country, as in parts of the European Union, we are asked now not merely to ignore, but actively to fear one's neighbor, and we're asked to do this by voices who claim to speak for the very religion whose leader's absolutely transparent message is, fear not. Permit me one historical example. On the back of your song sheet, there, is reproduced one of the earliest images of Gregory the Great, Pope from 590 through 604, from a late 9th century sacramentary, now in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. It illustrates what countless other portraits of Gregory have illustrated since. The white dove, of course, symbolizing the Holy Spirit, sings in Gregory's right ear. Can't be the left ear, it has to be the right ear. The music that is supposed to have written, that he is supposed to have written down and codified as the repertory of the church's song, what we call now Gregorian chant. This is also the origin of, you know, our little English saying, a little bird told me so. Now you know it was a Catholic bird. There's a detailed legend that attaches to this episode, which in fact this illumination is at pains to show, but which I won't elaborate. My point concerns not the story itself, but rather what purpose the story served. From this we can learn. In 753, the year 753, a year that's very important not only to politics, but also to music, maybe 150 years before this illustration came to be, Stephen II became the first Roman pontiff to travel northward across the Alps to meet with Pepin III, ruler of the Frankish kingdom, at Ponthion, which is now in northeastern France and called something else. His visit was by no means theologically motivated, although, you know, the story you would like it to be, but it's not. Rather, he came to ask for Pepin's military help in expelling the Lombards from Ravenna, the Lombards being a sect of Germans, for which favor the Pope pronounced Pepin the ruler of a united Frankish kingdom that encompassed most of Central Europe. You may remember this from your Western Civ classes. This is like ringing around your head. This was an extraordinary coalition of the spiritual and secular authority, culminating in the coronation, of course, of Charlemagne, the son of Pepin III, by Leo III, the successor to Stephen II, on Christmas Day 800 in Rome. This was the downbeat of the Carolingian Empire by the 10th century extravagantly renamed Holy Roman Empire, which held on to World War I, a north-to-south alliance centered actually in brutal military campaigns, forced migrations of great numbers of people, and genocide, but also an alliance that provided the political framework for a period in which learning and art flourished like never before. In fact, the university system we have today was born from it. Which brings me back briefly now to Gregory and his bird, his Catholic bird. The centralization of both secular and ecclesial authority that played out in the 8th and 9th centuries meant not least that the method of liturgical singing at home in Rome was imported northward into the vast Frankish lands. This sounds all right, sounds like a good thing, until you make the entirely reasonable assumption that folks in the very diverse parts of the Carolingian Empire did not take kindly to imperious outsiders dictating to them how to sing in church. In fact, already in the late 8th century, imperial policy supported the outright suppression of vernacular song repertories, vernacular song dialects, in order that singing practice be standardized. Music making became a kind of mortar in the brick wall of political stability. And it is no accident that the Gregory legend that you see there arose concurrently with these developments. If it were true, you see, that the Roman chant had been received directly from God, mediated by a single chosen and hence authoritative person, it becomes much more difficult to argue that your way of singing is just as good as that way. It's much easier, you see, to appeal to an orderly and all-knowing God than to the messy diversity of humanity and its vulgar practices. And vulgar, I don't mean that in the negative sense that we use it today, but rather the etymological sense of vulgar, the different practices of different people. Therefore, what you see in that illustration is at bottom a quite clever piece of propaganda in an elaborate imperial domestic policy designed to elevate sameness over difference, theory over practice, doctrine over lived experience. Therefore, too, the history of Gregorian chant, which I make my students call Franco-Roman chant, tends to be received as a history of sameness, not as a history of difference. How clean it is. How clean it is to appeal to God directly. How simple it can be to posit a personal relationship with the dove on the right ear that excludes others and privileges one's own agendas and ways of seeing the world to one's own advantage. It's much harder to deal with actual people, to live theology rather than to think about it, and to convince ourselves that God thinks about things like we do. The former way may or may not amount to a prudent kind of realpolitik, but the latter way is the only one that can hope to meet the challenge of identifying and loving the neighbor. Using my youth now as a lens that I told you about, it's the difference between admiring a cabinet and knowing how to build one, or between enjoying a cozy and idyllic winter's night in your home and knowing how your furnace works. You are all business people, which means, I believe, that your lives are bound up in market-based interactions with others. I have a German colleague who likes to say that monetary success might be a category of the economic market, but that it isn't a category of the gospel. That is certainly true, but it doesn't mean, nor does he imply it to mean, that business persons cannot live faithfully, obviously. My message here, as the last thing I'll say, I suppose somewhat provocatively, is not to get caught up in your love of God so much that you lose sight of your neighbor. You can talk all you want to a disembodied deity and believe that that disembodied deity is speaking to you, but this Neoplatonic approach taken alone won't get you very far in a religion organized around a God-made flesh executed on a cross. That religion is too much incarnated, much too messy, much too oriented toward the welfare of humanity that any of us can afford to write off the neighbor in whom, if we look closely, we just might see the divine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some questions. These were fabulous, fabulous.
I was wondering if both of you could talk about how you stay centered. What is your own faith practice like? How, what do you do daily or weekly to kind of keep yourself on track?
I'm a musician, and I live in music, and I my practice is a very kind of spiritual thing, actually. I can't explain that. I don't know how to explain it, but when I do that, and people leave me alone and I do that, I don't mean that negatively, it's just, you know, I have to put myself in a room and close the door, I do that. That's a very centering thing for me. I think a lot of musicians are that way. I don't think I'm unique at all. Yeah.
I am required now to drive a lot for my job, but I was pretty spoiled the last 6 years since moving downtown to be able to walk to work. And I try to have at least one day a week where I don't schedule any out-of-office meetings requiring my car so that I can dart and walk. And on the weekends, I also try to dart or bicycle or walk instead of drive, weather permitting, health permitting. Wow. But that is actually very important to me in the processing of ideas, and driving does not allow me the same headspace.
Who's next? Yes.
German or English?
Both, actually. It's, but the but the English version is first. It comes first, and then they translate it.
Is it out?
No. Oh, no.
Do you have a date for it to be out?
Well, no, I don't.
I saw another hand here. Anything else? Yes.
Do you see that maybe social media has destroyed our ability to report journalism the way it used to be?
The question is, has social media destroyed our ability to report the way news used to be? And I don't think that it's social media as much as it is advertising and the consolidation of media ownership. I think the consolidation of media ownership is really the foe of free speech, because it's impossible once you trace the ownership of the outlets high enough, there's a conflict of interest. Huh. And it's no longer, you know, once it became profitable, once news became profitable, its function as a public service to inform an educated citizenry and electorate fell by the wayside.
Well, I am lucky because I know both of you very well, and I would like to know what really delighted you about meeting and talking with each other.
So much.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Wow.
So we met before this speaking arrangement. We met through his Oregon advocacy when I was in the Arts District. So, but I think we hit it right off.
Oh.
We were talking last week about what we were going to talk about and sharing our remarks with each other and trying to be complimentary without repetitive, but what he said.
No, for me, it's, you know, Catherine has done so many different things at such a tempo, and they relate to each other so organically that I just wonder at that. That's just an amazing, amazing thing. It's something that, like I said, my background is very, very different and much more, I see it as much more monolithic. And so to speak to somebody like that, it just makes you shut up and listen, because there's so many. Well, you really, it's like what I tell my students, you know, reality never went to university. Yeah. And so, right, and so this ordering of reality into this box and that box, because, you know, and this box is the thing that you deal with at 10 o'clock to 11:50, and then this other thing is that reality isn't like that, and nobody works like that. Musicians have never worked that way, and if you look at them through that lens, it's a distorted lens. It's awful, actually. And this is the model for not doing that. It's fantastic.
I'm going to call on Dean Lawrence in just a second. Thank you so much for being with us. And as you know, one of the great things about being part of Southern Methodist University is being right across the street from the Meadows Museum. And here is the book on the treasures of the
House
of
Alba,
which I've just finished. You may have, I hope you came over to see it.
But we will
get you over there for the next exhibit.
Thank you.
Wow. Great. Absolutely.
I just want to take the privilege of making two observations that I was prompted to remember by the remarks of our two speakers. The first was Chris's comment about the matter of spiritual discipline and his comment about how important music and practice is. We had a provost here at Southern Methodist University who only lasted in office 9 months. And who really decided after about 3 months this job was not for him. He's a concert pianist. And what he told us as deans was that he realized that the job of provost meant he couldn't have 2 to 3 hours a day to practice. And the absence of practice was not a problem as far as losing piano technique, although that was true. What he told us was it was killing his soul not to be able to practice. the spiritual discipline that was vital to his identity, to who he is. My other comment is about something that Catherine observed regarding journalism and advertising. It's my understanding that back in the days when television was coming to the fore and decisions had to be made about who actually was going to be a TV network, how actually they were going to get a license to do this, there was a period of time when negotiations were underway to require the proposed licensees to carve out at least 30 minutes, preferably 1 hour a day, that would be entirely for news, and they could sell no advertising. The network licensees refused to do that. It would have been, for the last 70 years, dramatically transformative of American journalism if that agreement could have been struck. Thanks for coming.